The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Thursday, June 19th, and this is not a holiday here at American Family Radio Network, nor do I care personally that anyone else is celebrating or not today. But the top headline is from the Jerusalem Iranian ballistic missile struck a medical center on Thursday morning as sirens sounded across Israel following a barrage launched from Iran. There's been damage to the hospital along with extensive damage in various other areas. The hospital spokesperson stated rescue teams have been operating at the scene to help people trapped in an elevator at the hospital, and Israel Fire and Rescue Service is reporting that a man, 60, is in serious conditions due to wounds from the blast and shrapnel, along with three other people seriously wounded. So this is the latest escalation in this conflict between Iran and Israel in the midst of the overall broader conversation here in America about whether or not we should intervene and the wisdom of assisting Israel in not allowing Iran to have nuclear capabilities. And the context here for Christians, we talked earlier this week with my good friend Orrin McIntyre, who had a different view than I did and that I do theologically about the relationship that a nation, including the U.S., should have toward Israel. And this conversation was very much broadened yesterday when Tucker Carlson had an about 2-hour sit down with Senator Ted Cruz and got into everything kind of under the sun. This was kind of a mano conversation that was wide ranging. But they also keyed in on one critical point, which was how much of Ted Cruz's theology and his view of biblical prophecy plays into his view of foreign policy. And this is what I was talking about with Orrin earlier this week, that for Christians, necessarily, our theology dictates that. And I think for any politician, any world leader, anyone in elected office, their view of the world, their view of God, and whether that's the God of the Bible or they view a different lowercase g God, that necessarily informs their view. It informs their ethic, their morality, what they think of war, what they think of a lot of things, the wisdom of foreign policy. And so I want to play part of this exchange and then welcome in Steve Dace, who's my guest this morning. He had an excellent rant about this very same issue on his show yesterday, so I'm happy to have him on this morning. But I want to play for listeners who didn't watch that entire 2-hour interview. I'd encourage you to do that. But this is just part of the about 5-minute segment on Ted Cruz's view of Genesis, the Abrahamic covenant, and how that plays into his overall theological view of foreign policy. Listen to this.
Let's get into Iran momentarily. But you suggested it was a strange thing that I said a minute ago, that when I came into the Senate, I resolved that I was going to be the leading defender of Israel. And what you didn't ask is why. So let me tell you why.
No, you said I was obsessed with Israel, and you had just told me that, like, your driving motive to get to the Senate was to defend Israel. I'm I don't think I'm the one who's obsessed with Israel.
Okay.
Israel.
Tucker, words matter.
Uh-huh.
And you know that. I said I resolved to be the leading defender of Israel. And you said your driving motive, the reason you're in the Senate.
You want to be the leading defender of Israel. Well, I would think if I ran for Senate, I'd be like, there are people dying of drug ODs on the street.
My driving motive is to fight for Texas and America and to fight for jobs and to fight for the Constitution. And you played a very, very careful word game of a lie.
You're the one who said it, okay. Not me.
So you still haven't asked why, but I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
And the reason is twofold. Number one, as a Christian, growing up in Sunday school, I was taught from the Bible, those who bless Israel will be blessed, and those who curse Israel will be cursed. And from my perspective, I want to be on the blessing side of things.
Of the those who bless the government of Israel?
Those who bless Israel is what it says. It doesn't say the government of, it says the nation of Israel. So that's in the Bible. As a Christian, I believe that.
Where is that?
I can find it to you. I don't have the
scripture
off the tip of my...
All right, let's stop this here because, you know, this goes on. And as Steve rightly pointed out, this was a little bit of the, like, gotcha, you know, bar trivia night where, you know, I mean, I know what the Bible says, but can I always reference the chapter and verse? No. And that doesn't undermine the argument. It's like saying, I know it's in the legislation, but I can't tell you in the one big beautiful bill that it's exactly on page 273. Like, doesn't matter to the whole argument. But what I think... The issue that Ted missed in this whole thing is that Christians who view the Abrahamic covenant as an unrescinded unilateral promise from God to Abraham and his descendants through Isaac to possess the land of the nation of Israel is distinct, different, completely separate from any claim that the U.S. or any other nation must therefore support the government of Israel and any other policy decision. So the Genesis 12 argument here, supporting Israel's right, for example, to defend itself against Hamas, to possess the land, and the Abrahamic covenant being ongoing because God doesn't rescind those promises, is very different and distinct from the wisdom argument that we can all differ on and we can have a conversation about, a wisdom argument to not allow Iran to have nuclear capabilities. That is different substantially. So let's welcome in Steve Dace from The Steve Dace Show. And Steve, your thoughts on this overall?
Well, I think that an age-old argument, Jenna, that has raged in the church from really 70 AD until now, is returning. And I think that this is going to seem, you know, we're in an era maybe where more than ever before, we need to be able to think multiple things at once and nuance. Unfortunately, we're in the era we're least equipped to do it. Okay. And so we're going to hear things because we're seeing an Oron represents this, and I work with Oron and love the guy and know him well. Okay. We're seeing a resurgence of the historical, for the sake of this argument, I'm going to call the historical Christian view of Israel. We are seeing a resurging of that, particularly among young men who are coming back to the church in droves, but a lot of them are greatly attracted to Catholicism and Reformed theology. And because both of them offer historical context and application and cultural mandate that, frankly, a lot of the evangelical church of the last generation really did not. I mean, as long as you just voted Republican and called yourself pro-life and marriage was a man and a woman, nothing more was expected of you. You didn't have to go to a school board meeting, nothing else. There was no real historical context. Nobody really knew what was taught in our churches at all, really, the historical application of the church history, no real intellectual depth. I mean, you and I have been railing about that on here on your show for how long now, right? That very thing, right? Okay. And so young men are returning to the church right now, but the two branches they're returning to at the most, ironically, are the two that were at the most deepest odds during the Reformation. And that's what we know today as Reformed theology, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, Knox, the men of that era. And Catholicism. And so both of those actually have the same view. They differ on great many things, justification by faith, for example, veneration of Mary, for example. But they both agree on that the nation of Israel's prophetic significance ended in 70 AD. All right. And that was the historical view of the church collectively, this is what the church believed until the last couple of hundred years. All right. And so this is going to seem very new to many Americans and many Americans who've never heard this before. And we can get into the historical reasons for this. A lot of this view was lost within the church, because many of the churches that held it for, you know, from the time the Puritans arrived, that was their view. Many of those churches were the ones that became liberal in the early part of the 20th century. And the churches attached to the Moody Bible Institute were the ones that actually stayed true to the scriptures. And that was their eschatology. And so that filtered into the seminaries of evangelicalism. And so it's really all our people have ever been taught. And then a strong argument for dispensationalism as the default setting of most Americans is, you know, God does practice what is called small p progressive revelation. Paul alludes to this in the scriptures, right? Mysteries that were hinted at, all right, that the Jews couldn't quite understand what the suffering servant in Isaiah meant, for example. Well, now we know, all right, God has revealed that, solved that mystery for us, right? And so that revelation progresses through what are called dispensations. And so since there was no nation of Israel, even on the map whatsoever, there was really no reason to get to this point of revelation. So it's not a crime that it's a relatively new theory. It's actually the fulfillment of that progressive revelation. All right. So this is the only theory most of this audience knows. Mm-hmm. And I can just tell you, as someone who goes all over the country speaking at churches and has friends and all these various sections and movements, I can promise you, most of this audience doesn't know what amillennialism is and doesn't know what postmillennialism is. And this is going to be one of the smartest Bible audiences in America. And so this is going to seem, your young men are going to come home with books from Doug Wilson and things of that nature, and you're going to seem like you guys are all a bunch of anti-Semites. They're not anti-Semites. They just have a historical view. Now, at the same time, with what people like Candace Owens are promulgating, we have a real problem with anti-Semitic tropes, and we need to take that out to the trash. And so what we're going to have to figure out here is we're going to have to let people critically assess things and ask questions, because we're having an age-old debate. Much of the church believed for 1,700, 1,800 years, believed that when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, and that sparked and then the Jewish revolt against Rome, and that ended with the Emperor Titus ending the nation of Israel in 110 AD, and then that's where the term Palestine comes from. All right, he trolled the Jews after he ended Israel. He trolled the Jews by renaming it Palestine. Okay, and most of the Christian church believed until recently, the last few hundred years, that the advent of the Christian church and the end of the sacrificial system, timed with the ascendancy or the diminishing of those two things tied together, indicated an end of that age. That just as God had fulfilled his covenant, this is what's called covenantal theology. And it's not that God, doesn't keep his promises. He fulfills them. He fulfilled his promise, okay, to Noah, all right? He fulfilled the Mosaic covenant. This was the fulfillment, Jesus' last words on the cross. It is finished. The covenant is finished, all right? The covenant with Israel has been fulfilled. They have brought forth the Messiah, their ultimate purpose in the world, okay? And so now we are in the new covenant now, right? So this is what was taught for a long time. And it was just kind of lost here in the West, when many of those seminaries that taught that went liberal, and the ones that stayed true to the word were the ones that were important in the advent of what's known as dispensationalism. And you're seeing that old theology now kind of return, and Tucker is espousing many of those ideals. So I think it's going to sound like anti-Semitism to some people. I think it is perfectly fair to criticize Tucker by pointing out, listen, man, you have not been critical of Donald Trump in the last 3 years, except when it comes to Israel. That's a very, you know, sketchy thing, because history shows people who single out that kind of group of people are usually shady. That's all fair. It's fair to ask, why did Tucker bring on people like Daryl Cooper, a fake historian, that apparently, you know, read some things, and we need to deconstruct Churchill and Hitler. And didn't ask him any of the critical questions. He was right to ask Ted Cruz. Ask all the critical questions you want. And frankly, Ted's got to come up with a better answer than that, okay? But I think we're going to have to figure out how to give room for the resurgence and the young generation of men of a historical theology, and not immediately clamp down on it like it's anti-Semitism, because that's exactly how you're going to drive those young men who are searching and seeking truth. You're going to drive them right into the lap of people like Nick Fuentes and Candace Owens. All right. And so we're undergoing a generational change in the church right now. And some of it is a recovery of that historicity and some of these old debates. All right. Paul enters into these debates. All right. He says things like, not all of Israel is Israel. Okay. So until recently, with the advent of a nation called Israel, or what we call, and I'm a Zionist. I don't need Bible prophecy to be in favor of a nation of Israel. And I don't make prophetic arguments for why I'm in favor of Israel on my show. And I've got one of the largest platform biblical worldview shows by God's grace in America. Why? Because I'm aware of this debate. So I always tell people, I'm a Zionist, meaning that I believe there's no historical claim on that land for anybody other than the Jews. That's their land. Secondly, I don't care what your Bible prophecy view of the nation of Israel is. If a nation like Israel is strategically placed in the Middle East and wants to be our ally and is willing to be a cudgel between us and Islamic hegemony, particularly Shia Islamic hegemony, which is what Iran represents, all the worst Muslim nations in the world, they're all Shia Muslim, okay? If Israel wants to be a cudgel between the United States and us and them, I'm all for it. And if you look at the history of Islam, from the 7th century until the 20th century with the advent of the nation of Israel. It's not as if Islam was just great to us. See, these people will sometimes say things like, well, it's our alliance with Israel that causes this antagonism. You know, Crusades, first war this country ever fought, the Barbary Coast pirates from the halls of Montezuma. What's the next line? To the shores of Tripoli. That's Libya. That's North Africa. Muslim lands. Barbary Coast pirates, who literally were telling American ambassadors in the 18th century they were kidnapping and killing our soldiers because Allah told them to, right? So the idea that Islam just was totes cool with Christianity until we all got cozied up to these Jews is just entirely false. And in fact, during much of that period of history when Islam hated Christianity, Christians were terrible to Jews, okay? So you don't even want to read what Luther wrote. None of us are even here having this conversation about Martin Luther. Don't go when you're at work today. Don't go Google Martin Luther's views on the Jews. All right, you'll end up igniting all of the your watch guards of your company network. Okay, I mean the Christian Church has had a lot of different views about this than the one that it collectively has had in this last generation, and so some of these old debates are coming back again.
And I think that is a great overview and substantive, Steve, of why this is so important to talk about and why I've taken a lot of time this week in the context of Iran and Trump's response to Israel to talk about this. Because as you pointed out on your show yesterday, necessarily our view as Christians of theology of some of these debates will inform our policy viewpoints, and it should, rightly. But the point here, I think, as well, is that we need to have these conversations without immediately going to, well, if you believe in what dispensationalists would call replacement theology, then, you know, that's heretical. How could you possibly believe that? And you somehow confuse that with anti-Semitism. Or conversely, if you're a dispensationalist like I am and believe that the Abrahamic covenant is still ongoing, has not yet been fulfilled, in all of what we're talking about, and see that view, then that means somehow we are worshiping Israel, or there's right. A mix of it. You know, we're placing the government of Israel above the church, or, you know, some of these kind of quick gotcha sort of bad faith arguments that really shouldn't be attributed to how a rational Christian understands and views, because a lot of this does deal with eschatology. And my own pastor, and I had this conversation with our main teaching pastor, as well as a few of our other pastors and elders, when I became a member of my home church here in Florida, and, you know, asked their view substantively on a lot of different aspects of theology, because I want to obviously know what they teach and what I'm getting into. But when I asked the view on eschatology, I loved what my pastor said, which was basically this, and of course I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, I don't know, because it's in the future. And now I have the best rational, you know, argument based on a common understanding, based on seminary training, based on, you know, all of these things. But this isn't a matter of salvation, or if we disagree on one point of end times theology, then that undermines everything else. And I think that for too long, different denominations within Christianity have so specifically upheld one point of tertiary doctrine, not central to the Christian faith, not things like who is the person of Jesus, is he the Messiah, is he Lord? I mean, those are central questions that if we don't agree on that, we're a different faith, right? Like if you believe that Allah is the same as Jesus, you're not Christian. Like that's not within Orthodox Christian faith. But if there are tertiary issues that we disagree on, we can have those debates, and we should be having those debates. And I'm glad we're having these debates in this context. And the conversation with Tucker and Senator Cruz yesterday, I think, as you rightly pointed out, got off the rails a little bit because it was sort of some, you know, sideline stuff that didn't matter. But the point of having the conversation of how does your theology impact your policy views, we need to be asking those questions of every politician and every person seeking elected office, because I guarantee you, and I know this actually for a fact, that Trump's view of God necessarily informs his own perspectives. His worldview necessarily informs his perspective as well. That's why I'm glad he's in the Oval Office instead of Kamala Harris right now. So these things are important, well, but we need to debate them.
Let me say something I thought I'd never say in my life, okay, as someone who used to work for Senator Cruz. But I am actually glad Trump is in office right now and not Senator Cruz. Mm. And here is why. Okay? Because it is very clear that many of the assumptions we had about this region of the world and how to interact with it post 9/11 were wrong at worst and flawed at best. And right now is not a time. President Trump has a very difficult needle to thread, Jenna. On one hand, Iran cannot ever have a nuclear weapon, ever. No nation on earth has been more directly or partially or culpably responsible for the killing of Americans and our interests in the last half century than Iran. That can't ever happen, okay? Number two, we cannot get involved in another quagmire of regime change in the Middle East. That country is, especially in that country, it is 95% Shia. They've lost their central bank. They've lost internet. They've lost power. Where's all the young people of Iran we were told were just so anxious to throw off the Ayatollahs? Where are they pouring out into the streets? They're not. The worldview of that country is wrecked, all right? And Shia Islam is a bridge to the abyss, okay? And so how do you thread that needle? I think it's going to right now for this moment, I think what we need is someone who actually has no dogma in the argument that you and I just articulated, okay? Mm. While I understand Senator Cruz's view and where it comes from, and I adore his father, I just saw him last week at the Southern Baptist Convention, Raphael, all right, even as you just said, this is not something all Christians have always agreed on. To gamble our entire civilization on the possibility of a regional global war on an eschatological view that even people that adhere to it don't have all the same agreements. Well, is the rapture in the middle of the tribulation after a covenant that the Antichrist makes with Israel? Is it at the beginning? Is it at the end? Okay, but not even the people that adhere to this agree on all of its various forms. So to put the entire notions of the foreign policy of our nation on a theory that may be true, but even those who adhere to it have disagreements within it is a heck of a gamble, sister, okay? On the other hand, the idea that, well, who cares if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, you know? I almost went to work for Ron Paul in 2012, during the 2012 presidential campaign, till he did an event in Iowa, right before the Iowa straw poll, did a debate, and he said in the debate, well, if I was Iran, I'd want to have a nuclear weapon too, and I told his people, that's my tap out. I can't go there. As much as I detest Washington, And I love the crazy stuff he says about draining the swamp out there. That's a bridge too far for me. I cannot do that. Okay. And so I think what we need right now is someone actually doesn't have a dogma and someone who really is, even though Trump's pragmatism has frustrated me at times over the last decade, this is a time right now, by God's grace and his sovereignty, we have the right president right now. We need cold-hearted pragmatism. Nobody that wants to prove a point. Nobody that's got a theological nuance that they are convinced is true, even though people that share that nuance don't even necessarily have all the same nuances. Right now, we just need somebody whose only thing is, does it win? All right? And all Trump is so hardcore pushing back on Iran right now because the Israeli strike was so effective and devastating. If that Israeli strike had caused undue civilian casualties, you and I both know the president would be saying a lot different things the last 3 days. Okay? Mm-hmm. If that thing had not been as effective and precise as it was. That's what we need. What we need right now is a president who has the resolve to say, is this serving our interests? Yes, keep doing it. Is it not? Cut bait. Stop it. We don't need any more creedal, doctrinal, dogmatic assumptions in one way or the. I mean, Tucker Carlson sometimes sounds like, and I love Tucker. Frankly, I've had more communications with Tucker the last couple of years, Jenna, than I have my old boss, Ted Cruz. If I texted them both this morning, it'd probably be more likely Tucker would respond. So this isn't a personal thing for me where I'm just automatically siding with my former boss. But Tucker sometimes sounds like sounds like liberals who ask for gun control. And like the bad guys, if they see the no gun sign, will just leave their guns aside. It's like he wants us to pass war control. And the mullahs are going to be like, we're going to launch some mustard gas across the Rio Grande since when Biden let us all in the last few years. But the U.S. just passed war control. Do you see that? We can't have war anymore. So I guess we're going to shut the whole thing down and go home. That's not how the world works, Jenna. Okay. And so we cannot gamble this entire thing on the nuance of an eschatological theory, nor can we gamble this entire thing that, well, you know, maybe when bad people get bad weapons, they won't do bad things with them. The world's more complicated than that. And so what we need right now is someone who doesn't care about any of that. And all he cares about is winning. And that's all that matters, is pure pragmatism. And that's exactly what we need in the White House right now.
And we're going to have to take a break here, and this could be a lot longer conversation, and I hope it is a lot longer conversation. And Steve is going to stick around until after the break, but we're going to talk about another really important topic. But overall, I mean, I agree with you in this sense, Steve, that this is a wisdom issue. And I think that when Ted Cruz articulates this as kind of an overall touch point of scripture that it doesn't seem very fully developed, that can be dangerous. I think that a theological framework is actually important. And if we had someone like, for example, a Ron DeSantis, who has a theology but also is a pragmatist and views Iran and Israel and the conflict of the sense of this is a wisdom issue, that's where he and Trump agree and would overlap. But these are complicated topics, and we need to talk about them with grace, humility, and truly the best interests of America. So we'll be right back with more with Steve Dace. Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And our good friend Steve Dace from the Steve Dace Show on the Blaze, that you should follow at Steve Dace Show on X, remains with us. And this is, according to the LGBTQ Mafia, Pride Month, which basically just means that it's an excuse for corporations and the human rights campaign to try to shove the rainbow, their version that is absolutely perverted before the Lord of what the rainbow in context of Genesis actually means, their version of the rainbow down our throats. But Steve has had a wonderful response to this with a brand new book titled Richie Meets the Rainbow, a heartwarming tale of childhood enlightenment that you can get on Amazon right now. So Steve, tell us about this amazing book.
So we had an idea. Actually, my producer, Aaron, originally had this idea last summer of coming up with a quote-unquote children's book that really just tried to do a devastating satire of Pride. And I think he just kind of meant it as a throwaway line in a commercial break, but, I mean, a lightning in my head. And over the next 9 or 10 months, we worked on this project. I will tell you, finding a publisher, even on our side, who wanted to publish this was not easy. even for somebody who's written as many books as I have, you'd think we could find one. It wasn't easy. And then some who wanted to do it, just having an illustrator that was willing to do it and then could do it as fast as we needed it was not easy. I mean, remember this time last year, we don't know if, you know, Trump's going to prison. You know, we're a few weeks away from him getting shot in the face. You know, there was just a lot of uncertainty. We're watching the previous regime, Jenna, crack down on our belief system. And I just think a lot of people were scared of smashing the shibboleths of the damned. And so we ended up, I ended up having this, finance the book myself for the first time. I had to hire, I had to go all the way to Hungary, Viktor Orban's Hungary, to find an illustrator who was excited to do it and would do it in the time we needed. We came up with Richie Meets the Rainbow, a heartwarming tale of childhood enlightenment. And Richie, and we, I wrote it to rhyme like Dr. Seuss. It rhymes all the way through. You could read it to kids, you know, probably 9, 10 or older. But it's really a children's book, most of all for the adults. And I wanted to make sure that Dad was the hero of the story for a change. And so Richie ends up succumbing to what happens too often in our government schools. The blue-haired trainee teacher who's going to suddenly indoctrinate Richie. Except when Richie goes home, he has an antidote that sadly too many American kids don't have right now. It's called Dad. All right. And not just any dad, but something even fewer American kids have right now, a fully engaged dad. And so when Richie goes home from school and tells his dad at dinner what went on, Dad pulls out his ultimate weapon, the Bible, and uses that moment to teach Richie what the true origin of pride is. You guys ever notice they love to co-opt all the biblical imageries and symbolisms, but they don't ever want to tell everybody what the actual origin of all those things are. So it's time for Richie to be taught this. And then at the end, Richie's dad says, you know what? I think my job is to teach your school board these things too. Okay. And so it's meant to be funny, inspiring. We timed the release to get right at the heart of darkness of Pride Month, and do our part to drive that stake through its heart. And Jenna, we are right on the doorstep. I got to tell you, the Lord has been, you know, for a kid born to a 15-year-old mom, I'm one of the few authors to ever get to see one of his novels adapted into a major motion picture. I had the distinct honor of the New York Times giving my spot on its bestseller list to Greta Thunberg, even though I sold 170% more books than her. That was a great honor that they did that to me. But Jen, I got to tell you, of all the career achievements I could possibly have, being an LGBTQ best-selling author in the heart of Pride Month would probably top the list, Jenna, probably top the list. And I am on the doorstep of making that happen, okay? And so I'd love nothing more. You know, I greatly enjoyed my time, you know, broadcasting on AFR as I was working my way through national syndication. And I love Tim Wildman. He's been great to me over the years. He's the only person in this racket of ours I've met whose knowledge and obsession with college football rivals my own. Okay. So I'd love nothing more if the AFR audience was responsible this morning for putting us over the top. It would be just serendipitous, providential, maybe. Okay. I'm not going to get rich off of this. All right. This book was so expensive to produce. I'm making like $3 a book. All right. So to quote the Joker, it's not about the money. It's about sending a message. Okay. This would send a message to get us listed among the LGBTQ bestsellers. And we're right on the doorstep. Amazon, you got to get into the top 100 of that category to be listed as the bestseller there. And I think we're like at 112 or something last I checked last night before I went to bed. So I'd love it if the AFR audience went over there. It's just $15 a book. And went over to Amazon, R-I-C-H-I-E is how we spell Richie, R-I-C-H-I-E. And if y'all went there and put us over the top this morning, I would just think that that would just be a providential level of trolling.
Amazing. Well, Steve, thanks so much. And I will say to the AFR audience that I agree totally with this challenge this morning. If you can help us, and I say us because when Steve first texted me about this, I went on Amazon and bought a couple of copies as well. You can buy more than one, you know, hand them out to local school boards, give them, you know, to your pastor for handing out and to be able to contribute and help in this endeavor, I think, is part of ministry. And this is a great thing, Steve, that Christians should be engaging in these types of ways. Ministry and teaching truth is not just from the pulpit. It's also in meeting the culture at the moment. And this is what people like you, like Matt Walsh, in this area from Daily Wire, has done so effectively, and what my friend Robbie Starbuck continues to do. We're trying to get, you know, all of this DEI nonsense out of a lot of the woke corporations. This is all ministry. It's doing the work of meeting the cultural moment with truth. And so Richie Meets the Rainbow is available at Amazon. And if you want to participate in this and help out Steve, but for a great cause, I'm doing this as well, and I would really appreciate it. So we'll take our next break here. But Steve, thanks so much for doing this, for your willingness to always stand up and be on the front lines as a culture warrior, as Don Wildman says, and what his biography that we produce here at AFR is titled. And I love that title, because that's really what we are. Beyond being ambassadors for truth, light in the darkness, we are also culture warriors. So Richie Meets the Rainbow by Steve Dace. You can follow him at Steve Dace Show on X, and go to Amazon.com. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as I'm sure you have heard by now, the Supreme Court has ruled on the Tennessee law, which was a ban on gender transition, quote unquote, treatments for minors, which is basically genital mutilation, in a landmark case. And so the petitioners in the case argue that the law violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. That argument was soundly rejected by Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion. This was a 6-3 decision by the Supreme Court. And a couple of quick things here, and then we'll welcome in our next guest for his commentary on this. But you have, this is a 6-3 decision. You have three justices sitting on the United States Supreme Court. Of course, this was Kagan, Sotomayor, and Justice Jackson. Three women, liberal women, who are actually okay with this form of child abuse and actually advocating for it and writing strong, sharp dissent to the rationality of harming children and preventing that and allowing a legislature to ban that. I mean, this is how absurd leftism is and how important it is that we win elections for conservatives to make sure that judges and legislators and executives, everyone in government position, doesn't have these kinds of ridiculous viewpoints. Because imagine if the last couple of elections had gone differently and the Supreme Court looked different, where we would be with this case. It's utterly absurd. And the second thing is that I don't think that the majority opinion actually went far enough, because Chief Justice Roberts said that, and basically and I'm paraphrasing his majority opinion a little bit, they said, you know, this is a sharply contested issue, you know, blah, blah, blah. We'll defer to, you know, knowing that this is politically divisive. But the equal protection does not give us direction here. It doesn't adjudicate this dispute, basically. The legislature needs to do that. And so what the legislature has opined here in Tennessee, you know, that stands. And we're all for that because Tennessee did a good thing. They established a good law. But what about the legislatures in California and New York? Is Justice Roberts going to defer to them just because the Equal Protection Clause doesn't specifically direct him in this instance to protect children from harm? I think that is a terribly, terribly weak argument from the majority, and they should have smacked down this entire LGBTQ nonsense with a much more heavy-handed view because the law and common sense, frankly, supports that. So let's welcome in Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney and has previously been a constitutional law professor, has a lot of opinions on this. And Mike, your view overall of this case?
Well, Jen, it's great to be with you and your audience as usual. And folks can find me at Donnelly Speaks, where I call myself a constitutionalist and opinionated, as you pointed out. And of course, big shocker, I agree with you. I agree with you on all fronts here, but I guess I want to make the point that but for Donald J. Trump winning the election in 2016, this is a 5-4 decision the other way. Mm-hmm. If the court had not changed. Okay. Yeah. Kennedy, who was replaced by Kavanaugh, and Ginsburg, who was replaced by Barrett, would likely have found a way. I'm just guessing. We don't know what would have happened, right? But I think we can be pretty solid on that. But the this is a win. It's a big win. It's important. I share your, concerns regarding Roberts's majority opinion. But, you know, Thomas concurred. He wrote an opinion which was helpful. Barrett concurred. She wrote an opinion that was helpful, kind of clarifying some of these things. And Alito also wrote a concurring opinion. So I think they were also kind of a little bit uncomfortable with not taking a stronger stand on the issue. And that's what you get with Justice John Roberts.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right that it providentially, and I think that the 2016 election was a pivotal point in America's history and in a kind of waking up a lot of people in the now MAGA movement that wouldn't be engaged in politics at all. I mean, we mentioned Robbie Starbuck previously. I mean, he's one that, you know, ended up running for Congress out of Tennessee, who hadn't and then ended up being disqualified ridiculously by the GOP because he hadn't voted in a couple of prior elections. And he said, you know, I woke up because I saw through what Donald Trump went through in 2016 and then everything that he did in his first administration, how important this is. And so we need to be engaged. And I think the question then with these three ridiculous liberal women, which a user on X pointed out yesterday that, you know, two of them are childless. And a lot of these, I mean, just like Kamala Harris, right? And a lot of these very, very extreme leftist views are being driven by liberal childless women who want state-funded abortion on demand, have this overarching view that children belong to the state. I mean, all of these things, these ridiculous views, mm-hmm. and it could have gone the other way. And so the question then becomes, where are we going from here?
Mm. That's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked it because I wanted to make the point. You know, I really appreciated what Justice Thomas wrote in his opinion. He said, this case is a useful reminder that the American people and their representatives are entitled to disagree with, quote unquote, so-called self-described experts. And courts may not sit as a super legislature to weigh the wisdom of legislatures. Now, that's a federal judge and the federal court. So as a federal matter, this is pretty much dealt with. I mean, there may be some litigation that pushes on the Equal Protection Clause, but I think we've resolved this issue that transgenderism is not a suspect class and doesn't get heightened scrutiny at the federal level. But this is not the end of the discussion. There are two cases in Montana and Ohio in state courts with existing injunctions issued by state district judges against similar laws, which are making their way up to the Supreme Court in Montana and Ohio. Now, I have some confidence in Ohio that they'll come to the right conclusion, but there are a lot more arguments that the pro-mutilation, the pro-transgender insanity crowd can come up with in the state courts. And so the people who want to protect children, and let's call this law what it was, can we please? This was a law to protect children from life-altering, destructive, experimental I don't even want to call them medical procedures because they're not medical. This is Frankensteinian. Maybe I can coin the term, Frankensteinian. Totally medically unethical procedures, okay? And so from that perspective, let's just be clear what this, what these laws are about. They're not banning medical procedures. They're protecting children from Frankensteinian, non-medically, non-ethical procedures, okay? So if there are doctors out there who disagree with me, fine, let's have a conversation about it. But people who are practicing this kind of experimentation should not be licensed as doctors. Okay, I'm just going to say that. So where are we going? From here, we're going to the state courts. You know, the left and the, I don't know what to call the people who are for this kind of craziness. They're going to continue to argue, and they have arguments to make in state courts based on state constitutions. And there are plenty of crazy state judges who are going to go along with this kind of stuff. So wake up, America. Get ready to fight in your states because that's where the battle is going.
Well, and so, and I think you're absolutely right on that. And so what happens then within the framework of Roberts' opinion and the majority decision here, what happens when there is a California legislative action, for example, that says, we're totally fine with this, we defer to the experts, and, you know, we're allowing this, and then it's challenged by a conservative group? Does the Supreme Court in its current majority say, well, hey, we defer to the legislature?
Well, I think the facts will matter. I'm not imagining under what context the conservative group is going to be able to challenge that. I mean, we talked about the Colorado case, you know, in relation to some issues recently. You know, it becomes challenging, I think. I mean, I think the Supreme Court doesn't want to have to deal with this anymore. They kicked abortion to the states. They're relegating this to the states, which I think is the right thing to do. You know, we've had this conversation about federalism. We live in a federal republic, and the states need to be the places where we make these decisions, in my opinion. Okay? And so I'm much more comfortable with having this argument at the state level, but it does mean that we, the people, need to wake up and be ready for it. It's coming. We weren't ready for it when Dobbs happened, and we lost when we shouldn't have lost in some places. Okay? Because we weren't ready. So get ready, you state policy councils, you state conservative groups. It's coming. It's already in Ohio and Montana, and it's coming to a state near you. So prepare.
And you know, that's very well said, because I don't think that we can, as conservatives, expect the Supreme Court to be the oligarchs in robes and make all of these policy decisions, as much as, you know, hopefully they will always rule on the side of truth and of the Constitution. There are some things outside of their appropriately delegated authority to opine on and to adjudicate. And so, you know, here, if we're true federalists and looking at policy in the way that you just suggested, Mike Donnelly, I mean, it really does matter where we're at in the states. And it matters for parents to know that if you still live in, you know, one of these blue states, I mean, looking at the Colorado law that's potentially, you know, happening, that you can have criminal charges if you don't adhere to your child's preferred pronouns. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous. Then maybe you want to move to a state that actually protects your children and protects your parental rights in a way that's conservative. And so if we do truly have 50 laboratories of democracy, we have to make sure that all of those 50 laboratories are functioning conservatively, and we know that they're not right now. And there needs to be a lot more engagement on the state level instead of just looking to the Supreme Court to save us every single time. So last minute, last word, Mike Donnelly, and thanks so much for your commentary and bringing us back to federalism.
Yeah, and at Donnelly Speaks is my X handle. Join me there. I'd love to get some more followers there. We have some conversations, but I think that's it. You know, we are a federal republic. We're not always going to agree on things. People can move from one place to another, and they're doing that. The blue states are losing population. The next census is going to be pretty dramatic. You know, again, going to the point of what the Democrats are trying to do with the open border policy. They see what's happening. I'm bullish about 2026. I think things are going in a better direction. But look, this is a fight. We cannot shrink from it. This is about our kids. This is about truth. This is about morality and justice. And we've got to elect good governors. We've got to elect good people to the Supreme Court and, you know, be ready to fight.
Well said. All right. Well, follow Mike Donnelly at Donnelly Speaks, and you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And we'll see you tomorrow morning for a very happy Friday.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.